However, unfortunately, most fishing communities on the Kenai have actually become more specialized over time. So they're not, our communities haven't been diversifying, they've been specializing. On the northern Kenai, I mean, sockeye is huge, especially in the commercial fleet. There used to be more diverse harvest of a wider variety of salmon species, and now it's become much more focused on sockeye. And this specialization, putting all our eggs in one basket, could reduce our economic resilience to major changes like climatic regime shifts. Or in this case, because kings and reds run at the same time, a downturn in kings can shut down the sockeye fishery. So it's a very fragile system. It's a hard problem. Obviously, sockeye is a super valuable resource. It's not easy to just say, oh, we should catch more pinks or, you know, something else. Obviously, our fishing fleet is fairly specialized, and it's true, you know, as well for the sport fisheries, but the sport fisheries have diversified quite a bit to focus on other species other than kings during the king downturn. So I think it's an important question to ask as policymakers, government leaders, community members, people who fish, how can we promote diversification and flexibility in our fishing communities so that somehow build flexibility into the governance so people aren't locked in with, say, quota where they can only target one stock, where they maybe fishers could have more flexibility to harvest what's available in any given year. Hard questions, but I think worth addressing. So take home messages. As Alaskans, we have local control over many of the factors influencing our future salmon runs. So the climate is changing really rapidly. It should be cause for concern. It's a really big deal. It's already affecting our salmon. But it's not all negative. The salmon are not all going to die because of climate change anytime soon. There's going to be new opportunities. And we have the chance to, through our actions and our habitat conservation decisions, we have a chance to help salmon do better given the changing climate. In particular, maintaining a diversity of options, so strong habitat protections, as well as economic diversity, may allow salmon runs and fishing communities to continue to thrive in the face of change. So I'd like to thank our funders, but I'd just like to say, Sue, I think, is the combination of skills that Sue brings to the table, being a visionary as far as measuring stream temperatures when most people didn't think that was a very important thing in Alaska, trying to understand how do those measured temperatures affect salmon, a whole completely different ballgame, and then what do we do about it as local communities? What can we do to help these fish given this climate change? Sue is probably the only person in the state I know of who does all three things well. So it's been a pleasure to work with her. And
thanks, Eric.
Recent declines in Chinook salmon populations have severely impacted fishing communities, cultures, and economies throughout Alaska. We know that the ups and downs in salmon runs can be partially explained by changing ocean conditions as salmon grow. But are Chinook runs also influenced by changing freshwater conditions where they spawn and rear? With Alaska's climate warming twice as fast as the global average, our research team, led by the University of Alaska, set out to understand if Chinook declines are related to climate-driven changes in freshwater habitat. Using long-term data collected by the Alaska Department of Fish and Game and Cook and the Keeper, we investigated how freshwater habitat conditions, such as water temperature and stream flow, varied year to year in Cook Inlet streams supporting 15 different Chinook populations. We estimated the productivity of each population over the period 1980 to 2009. Productivity was defined by how many surviving offspring were produced by each spawning adult. By looking at yearly changes in productivity, we could determine which freshwater conditions were associated with larger or smaller runs. Across the region, salmon were consistently less productive during years with heavy rains in late summer and fall when adult salmon spawn and their eggs incubate in the stream bed. These flooding events can result in incubating salmon eggs being crushed by stream bed gravel or smothered by heavy loads of fine sediment. However, salmon were more productive when they experienced above average summer rainfall as juveniles. Higher stream flows create more habitat overall and allow juvenile salmon to access side channels and floodplain habitats, which can be rich in food resources. Stream temperatures had more variable effects. During hotter than average years, salmon were less productive in many of the warmer lowland rivers in the region and more productive in the colder mountain streams. However, for all Chinook populations, productivity declined significantly when stream temperatures went above 64 degrees Fahrenheit for a week or more during spawning. These findings provide important evidence that climate-driven changes in freshwater habitat do influence the ups and downs of Chinook salmon populations in Alaska, with patterns similar to those observed in the southern part of their range. Specifically, heavy fall rains and hot, dry summers likely contributed to recent Chinook declines and Cook Inlet fishery closures. More field research is needed to better understand cumulative impacts of ocean and freshwater conditions on salmon survival to guide management of our valuable fisheries and to give Chinook salmon a fighting chance in a warming world. For more details, check out our open access paper in Global Change Biology. And that was just what they call a video abstract of our paper that basically touches on a lot of the themes that Eric talked about. And I have to tip my hat to Eric. He gave an amazing amount of information in his talk and really appreciate the full context of the reality of our changing streams here in Alaska. So thanks, Eric. Talk about some things that I've learned over the years. I've been here at Cook Inlet Keeper and for 20 years and have been enjoying most of that time out in the field and getting to learn about all of our salmon streams. And really the start of my work came from noticing that the streams seemed warmer than I thought an Alaska stream should be when I first moved up here. And so I stuck a temperature logger in the creek just to see what the temperature was and was surprised. And that kind of started about 18 years of field work looking at how temperatures vary across Alaska and what that means for salmon. So I'm gonna share a little presentation here, and it will not be super long. So we'll hopefully have lots of time to have some conversation at the end. So I want to, I'm gonna review a little bit of some of the key points of what Eric mentioned, and actually that even Brent started us off with in terms of how, you know, kind of the rate of change that we've been seeing over time, and then to show you what we think is gonna happen in the future. And hopefully that will inspire us all to think about what we can do to make sure that the salmon have as much resilience as possible into the future. So this is, if you can see nothing else, note generally that the blue lines are heading up. So this is a graph of about 40 streams across the across the Cook Inlet watershed. And you'll see they're grouped in different regions. So hoping you can see my cursor here. There's a bunch here on the Kenai. These are all the Kenai streams that we have been measuring temperatures in. And all of these streams are increasing over the last 50 years from 1980. And on average, they're increasing by about a half a degree a decade. And even on in the Kenai River, you know, we think of these glacial systems as so much colder, but even over time, we're seeing an increase in a system like that as well for summer temperatures. Now, one way you can also think of this is the kind of slow start of a boil, right? So this is the overused frog in the pot, and that we're just sort of slowly simmering along. And unless you're actually measuring it, you wouldn't really notice it. And things have started to really accelerate in the last 20 or so years. And this is a graph to just give you a sense that even though all these streams are increasing, they are also expressing really different temperatures. So not all streams are the same. And Eric certainly made that point. And that they're really being driven by different things based on where they are in the landscape. And so we have certain streams. So down here, Sildovia River on the south side of Ketchmack Bay, or Quartz Creek there in the Central Peninsula, those are really cold water streams. And there's the data from 2009, and these are weekly temperatures for 2009. But then we have some streams that are really very warm, and these are, you know, getting into the, you know, 68 to 70 degrees. And that is well above this 64 mark that Eric mentioned when the adult salmons particularly are very impacted and we start to see some of that pre-spawn mortality happening. So this is what it looked like in 2009. And we were able to, because of all that great airport data that we have, that air temperature information that we have, we can begin to use that to help us backcast and then forecast into the future what we think temperatures will look like into the future. And so we did some work in this paper back about 5 years ago, looking at how these temperatures might increase into the future. And so this is using data climate models from folks at UAF. And the thin lines show the stream specific projections we have for 2030 to 2039. And then the darker, the thicker line is for 2060 to 2069. And the reason there's a range is because there's a lot of different models, and some of them are more pessimistic and some of them are more optimistic. And generally we're finding that the more pessimistic models about how fast things are changing are more accurate than the more optimistic models. So this is what we understood about these streams back in, this paper came out in 2016. And so that was kind of what we were thinking, is like, this is what, how fast things are gonna change in the next 50 years. And then 2019 happened. And so the orange dots are the streams where we are still monitoring temperatures. And those are the values that we saw in 2019. And so we reached or exceeded the maximum stream temperature values predicted for 50 years in the future in 2019. So things are happening faster than we feared. And granted, you know, this summer was much cooler. We still are on an overall trajectory that is upward and that is going upward quickly. And so what is interesting to me about this to think about is, so now we know which streams are the most that are warming fastest and warming into really warm temperatures. So we saw temperatures in the 80 degrees on the Deshka River up in the Mat-Su. But the other thing to think about is, you know, as Alaskans, we are really connected to certain streams. Like we have communities that live on one river, and that's where everyone fishes. That's where all the businesses are associated with. That's where the income is coming for that community. And so by having stream specific information about how systems are changing, I think it really gives us a nice planning tool for all those communities to understand whether they're on the front edge of that warming or if they are in a location that's going to be slower to warm and maybe in really prime condition and really productive into the future. So overall, 2019 is sort of an indicator of where we're headed, and we're likely to see warm and low freshwater conditions, and we're going to see salmon responding both physiologically and behaviorally
by the adults. And so, for example, they'll hold and lower down in the river to try to avoid having to move through that really warm slug of water. So we see that behavioral response. And then physiologically is where we see the pre-spawn mortality, where they just can't navigate that warm water. And we saw that in 2019 for all five species all over the state. It impacted sport, commercial, and subsistence fishermen. So pretty dramatic. And I share that just to help get you in a sort of motivated mindset that this is something we need to think about and something that we need to think about for solutions. So that was the story for the adults. And of course, for the eggs and the juvenile life stages, the impacts from 2019 are not yet known. And this is something to think about is like, do we have the tools we need to learn from what 2019 is telling us to help the managers actually deal with these dramatic events and make sure that we're managing our fisheries in a way that is going to be proactive? And I'll get back to that point in a moment. But I guess back to the point of, I want us to be thinking about how much salmon mean to us and that fishing means to us, whether it's for salmon or other species, that we have a real connection to our both our river systems and the ocean. And we even have planes that have salmon on them. Like, we are a salmon culture. We are salmon people. We live in a salmon landscape, and we have a real, as Alaskans, it's one of the few things we can all agree on, is that we all really appreciate what salmon bring to our lives and to our landscape. And so to me, that begs some questions then. So if we know that things are changing rapidly and that it will impact certain places pretty dramatically, certain runs are going to be affected. We're seeing some impacts in Cook Inlet Chinook already. It begs some questions. And to me, those questions are, one, are we doing enough to monitor and manage our fisheries during this time of rapid change? Second, are we doing enough to build resilience and to protect habitat diversity using land management tools? And then finally, are we doing enough to draw down our emissions and to address the climate crisis to give salmon a fighting chance? Because ultimately, we have a role in this on both really small personal scales and then in that larger movement to do something about the climate crisis, all in the name of salmon. So I'm going to share a couple of examples of ways that I think we are doing something, but also to maybe in sort of the conversation at the end about, are we doing enough? And what are some other ways that we could accomplish tackling these topics? So in terms of if we're doing enough monitoring and are we managing our fisheries appropriately in this time of rapid change, some of the things that are happening, Fish and Game has many systems where they have fish weirs. And so they actually can count the number of fish that are returning back to a specific system. And that's a very hands-on, a very important data set that requires a lot of resources. Fish and Game is one of the things that we need to be thinking about when we think about our financial crisis on the state, and that we need our department to be strong so that we have really good data at this time when we really need as much information as possible. So having resources for fish weirs, and now we're beginning to have data sets that can really help them think about how those fish are being impacted by our changing climate. So one example is on the Deschke River, where they have a long-term fish weir, and Cook Inlet Keeper has set up a real-time temperature site. So we actually can look at how the fish are responding in real time to the temperature. And we don't actually have that combination of data at very many places. And I think it's something that we really ought to look to build a lot more networks of that real-time information. And so that graph in the middle is showing you how we can use those two pieces of information. We can look at the Chinook count from the weir in the blue, and then the orange is the temperature data, and look at how once we get over about 20 degrees Celsius, which is 68 degrees Fahrenheit, that we begin to see the fish stop moving, that they really slow down. So you know, basically once we get to about here, the fish just stop and they hold until the temperatures begin to come down. And so for a fish manager, that's really helpful to understand, why all of a sudden there's no fish moving through the weir. Is that because the run is over, or is there actually a thermal bottleneck that's slowing the fish down? So having that kind of information in real time, super important. And I think it is kind of something that we need to be pushing the department to be doing more of, to help us know that we are understanding how the fish are being impacted in particular systems. But is that enough? What other pieces of information would a fisheries manager need to be able to understand the impacts of a changing, both the hydrology of the system and the temperature of the system? So something to think about. And this is one that's really near and dear to my heart, because I think it's really, as a stream ecologist, somebody who really loves the complexity of rivers and the diversity in that habitat, like this is really where it's so easy to let habitats slip away from you if you're not paying attention. It's where most places across the world have lost their salmon, is because they slowly let their habitats slip away from them. And so the question is, are we doing enough to build resilience and to protect habitat diversity with land management tools? And so how do we give the stream more resilience against the temperatures like we saw in 2019? Well, as Eric mentioned, things like having shade along a stream side can be surprisingly important. Even though you think of the water as moving, those locations that are shaded actually do provide cooler places for the fish to hold out to stay away from that warm water. Protect cold water habitats. I'm going to show you some cool images here in a minute related to that, but there are places in the river that are always colder than in the summertime. They're always colder than the main channel, and that's because they have groundwater coming in, and those are really important places. And so we really need to think about how we can identify those places and protect them, because those are going to be critical for fish to be able to move up and down rivers in the future. And then some of the other things that Eric mentioned related to flooding and how do you keep those huge torrents of water that'll happen in a really big flood event, how do you keep that river able to deal with that? How can you keep that water from just flushing out the channel and all of the eggs that might be in the gravels? And how do you make sure that you have a good floodplain for the water to be able to disperse its energy and create places where the fish can get out of that flow for the juveniles? So things like having wetland protections, because wetlands actually act as these wonderful sponges and they actually help to reduce the impact of a big rain event. They soak up a lot of that water and slowly release it into the river. And so they actually keep the flows down during a big event. Having riparian buffers and floodplains intact, because it's all like friction, places that'll slow the water down and keep some of that pounding in the channel from impacting the gravels. And then also the green stormwater infrastructure, keeping the water quality of the water that's going over all of our parking lots and areas that might have a lot of contaminants in it. So those are just some of the really, they seem so basic, and yet they're so easy to lose with just not having those things front and center when you're developing your human space on a salmon landscape. So I want to show off some new stuff. We got this thermal imagery this summer, and it's really exciting to me to actually have visuals of what the temperature is in a river. I spend so much time with thermometers in a river, and it's difficult to really understand how much variation there is in the temperature in a stream channel. And so this thermal imagery is a really powerful tool. And so this is stuff we work with this wonderful contractor in Oregon and they come up and they fly from a helicopter. They have this thermal camera and they fly about 1,000 feet high and they get a 2-foot by 2-foot pixel image of a river channel. And so these are some images that we collected this summer. We've got on the left is the Deshka River, which is that river I mentioned up in the Mat-Su that's very warm. And so these three pictures are all examples of tributaries, like discrete tributaries bringing in much cooler water. And in some cases, they're a pretty big tributary, like on the Deshka, you know, you would think of that as like a little river coming into the Deshka. And something like the ones we can see on the Funny River and Crooked Creek, those are really just very small, like little, the one up top on the Funny River is like a little spring system that's cutting through the, it's probably an old oxbow actually. So maybe before that road went in, the river might've actually had a different channel, but it's still bringing in really nice cold water. You can see the difference. These temperatures are in Celsius, but so 9.4 versus 15.3 degrees Celsius. So really nice, nice cool tributary there. And then the same on Crooked Creek. And so those spring systems are super important. They bring in groundwater, and groundwater is typically about the average annual air temperature is usually your groundwater temperature. So it tends to be nice and cool in the summer. It's also really important habitat in the winter because it stays that same temperature. And so everything else is freezing up, and those springs can actually be really important overwintering habitats. So really key places on the landscape. So those are super fun to see. And then here's an example from the Deshka that I think is really interesting to think about when we think about, we've been talking about like streamside vegetation and the importance of that riparian zone. Well, here's a great example of how there's basically groundwater just seeping out through this bank on the right side. And that's basically, there's a big hill, and so there's just groundwater seeping out into the creek from that spot. And so having that area shaded and with that groundwater coming through is really important habitat. And so really that would be hard to find in the field. If I was just wandering around with a thermometer, that would be a hard location to be able to find. And so it's great to have these images to help us see that. So the final issue is even if we did all of our fish management well, and if we used all the tools we could to keep our habitat healthy and diverse and intact, is that going to be enough? And to me, the answer is no, that it's gonna take even more than that, because we are seeing this rapid acceleration of our climate conditions, as we saw in 2019. And so we really need to think about how do we begin to be part of the solution of slowing down the rate of our changing climate conditions. And so I've got some thoughts here on the slide. We have a drawdown program that's going on to help folks find local solutions to help bring down our carbon emissions. In the Soldotna area, we have folks doing community compost and looking at ways to get more things out of our landfill and not letting it contribute to our methane emissions, and to actually bring it out and make it into chicken feed. It's like a win-win. And then there's also been a great effort to solarize the Kenai and to help people think about ways to embrace renewable energies. And then, of course, we have our new Resilience and Security Advisory Commission, which is a potential place for more of this conversation about what we can do locally to help be a part of the solution. So in the spirit of like, what is it, like, we're all here because we care about our fishing resources and that economy and the fish. And for me, when I think about climate actions, I think about, well, for the love of fish, what would I do? And so we did solarize this year, and I think of them with salmon on my brain, that I'm doing that for the long run and for salmon for the future. So I'm excited to to stop talking and to hear some questions and to hear some thoughts from you all about, like, what does this make you want to do in your community, and how can we help the salmon for the long run?